We are live.
Yes, sir.
I don't want you to call. And I don't want you to clap. I don't want you to call. I don't want you to clap. I want to talk to you about some things. You know, it should be obvious that we're working very hard to make it possible for me to decipher as best we can through the manuscripts what Paul actually said, or whatever biblical book I'm working with. I don't know who. I think I'm going to outlive everybody, so I don't have to worry about it. But I started to say, I don't know who would be the person to sort out my library when I die. I mean, I got books that nobody on earth can find. Not only what you put on display. This old classic beats about anything that I have in my library. It's called Barrett's Grammar. English, Latin, Greek, German, Spanish, and French. All together. This classic work done. Now, most of the languages of the modern world have deteriorated. I mean, I saw the most idiotic thing and heard the most idiotic expression that tells me where the world's going. I don't watch many movies. If I do, I collect old movies when you didn't have the special effects, computer idiots and nerds, when people really knew how to act, or were a strong enough personality, they could play themselves and you still enjoyed it no matter what they did. Now we got a bunch of little pretty boys and a few vacant-headed broads that probably got their parts for the producer's couch and special effects that affect nobody with brains. So Nightline was heralding the accomplishments of Marlon Brando. He changed the film industry. And one of the reviewers said the thing that he did, starting with On the Waterfront, which I was never terribly impressed with any time, one of the greatest movies ever done. He changed Hollywood, because up until then, actors enunciated and carefully phrased their words until you could understand them, which is not normal and not the way any ordinary person talks. That's what this reviewer said. So Marlon Brando came along and was himself. And from On the Waterfront to The Godfather. I don't watch movies today because I can't stand them. I don't know what language they're talking. They don't speak English. I mean, that poor old guy and My Fair Lady, even he could not make... I mean, that slum girl was easier to teach the English language than modern actors. Even he could not make modern actors and actresses speak until you could understand them. I don't know what jive is controlling this modern world. If they were preaching, as I do, you would never know whether they're speaking Arabic, Ethiopic, English, French, French, another French, when I speak it. We don't have scholars today, absent me. I mean, I had that same attorney that was talking to me earlier in the week. If you were to tell me, what theologian in today's world would you recommend that, if you could choose someone to listen to? I said, me. She said, beside And that had nothing to do with the fact that I never stopped working when I got out of school. They did. She said, really? I said, yeah. Nobody? I said, they're all dead. Yeah, I can name several of the previous generation. And scholars like this. When have you last seen somebody produce a book like this? Why do you think some of these classical languages are called dead? They're dead because today's deadheads don't want to put forth the effort to learn them. I mean, somebody died recently and that tons of junk may rescue some Native American Indian languages in this land. Just his scribble note. This is written in The Principles of Grammar, being a compendious treatise on the languages. You know, if I were teaching in school, I could make kids want to learn grammar. It's the most hateful. How many of you remember friends in school that were eager to take their English classes? Principles of Grammar, being a compendious treatise on the languages English, Latin, Greek, German, Spanish, and French, founded on the immutable principles of the relation which one word sustains to another. By Solomon Barrett Jr., philologist, 1859. The opening picture has a picture of a tree with God written down here, which is what's... Well, yeah, try to get the camera on it. God's written. You don't have to see the picture up close. You can zoom in. Try. You never used that camera before, but try, because we have volunteers here today. Maybe you can see the word God. Can you see it?
Yes, sir.
Well, that's where it ought to start. And, of course, no modern person would ever believe that God confused the languages at Babel. God, who spake at sundry times and divers manners and times past, unto the fathers, by the prophets, in these latter days hath spoken unto us by his Son. At least he starts out believing things like that. And then he opens the opening. You know, he's willing to have the pages of the opinion of the press. When this came out, it was eulogized around the world. And then he has 10 theses. Let me tell you what it says in... You never know what you're going to hear when you tune me in, do you? Not easy to turn the pages of these old books. That's why I photograph them, then I can mark them up, butcher them, and do anything. The 10 theses applicable to all languages. Learn these 10 theses when you're ready to start studying even English. 10 theses. Applicable to all languages. I'll find it. Just relax. One of the more interesting ones is this fifth thesis. The ancients wrote their language to be read from the right hand to the left. You know, it's like go to Anguilla or Britain, they drive on the wrong side of the road. We're always right and everybody else is wrong. Right from right to left doesn't come natural to us. But that's the way the ancients wrote. And without spaces between their words. Consequently, all Greek and Latin verbs are compounds. And Greek and Latin are to be read in their compounds from right to left. It's not what you think he's saying. After having reduced them to their simple elements by separating mentally or by spaces, the root, conjugation, mood, and tense, number, and person. Splendiat is not a single word to be read from left to right, which is the way we read it. Write it down on a piece of paper. S-P-L-E-N-D-E-A-T. Splendiat. Now, it's a word that means to give light. But it's not a single word. We read it from left to right, but its origins are to come from right to left. It has five distinct parts beginning at the right. The first is the person and number, T. May is the E. The T, which is person and number, for it. The A, third person, E, second conjunction, the E is, again, third person, second conjunction, the D is the root for to give, and five, splen, is the root word for light. So that whole word breaks down into the root, splen, write light under it, D, give, E, may, and the sub pronoun in it, may, is the A, he is the second person conjunction, and the T is it. So the whole word means light, give, may it, by working backwards, which could be traced in these words back to the old ancient Aryan language of Sanskrit. Now, Sanskrit's the most typical language I've ever tackled. Bad enough to learn to write the Sanskrit, but they have, for example, they have eight cases, whereas, thanks to the Baptists in the New Testament Greek, it's been reduced to five in the Greek. And this whole book goes through every one of these languages and how they grow from the common source of the Indo, all the Indo-European languages grow out of that common source of the Aryan tribes that confronts us in modern literature. No, it's not modern, but Sanskrit. Take a picture of the Sanskrit. Now, this guy has mastered all of these, all 10 theses. I misread one of the letters, but all 10 theses. Zoom in as close as you can. That's Sanskrit. We don't really have, you're not focused properly, so you got to focus better than that. I'm not sure. But you can see how wild it looks. It looks like a combination of Armenian and Persian, which it is. Persian grows out of it. All the Indo-European. Out of Sanskrit come the roots of most of our languages. Now, I have a reason for doing this. This godly man, the most erudite in language that maybe I've ever encountered, he has a translation of Romans 3. Let me find it. And I'm going to ask, I'd like to ask the camera because it can't talk back. Am I boring you? Romans 3, 21 to 26, page 212. Now you would think that I could open this and find a man that is so thoroughly and completely controlled by his knowledge of the language that the traditions of the church mean nothing, wouldn't you? I mean, he knows more than all the bishops. He probably knows more than the Pope. certainly knows more than the head of the Anglican Church. He's a master philologist. He sees the relationships in all these languages. So you would think he's going to translate without fear or favor, right? Okay, Romans 3:21-26. He's got, in this case, the Greek, nuni de choris, but now, chasms apart, he translates without, nunc, verlapsci, legi, that's the Latin, dikaiosuni, the righteousness of Theou, God, remember that Theou, I'm going to come back to that, is manifested. And I love the fact that when he comes to the 22nd verse, he says, even the righteousness of God, diapisteos, by faith, Jesu Christu, he translates it right, of Jesus Christ. And you think he would continue. So we come to the 26th verse. Through the fair forbearance of the God, for declare the righteousness of him at the present time, that he might be just and the justifier. You'd think he would recognize that just does not translate dikaion, and justifier does not translate dikaionta, because it's the same word that he just translated righteousness, dikain osunis. He didn't have the guts to make up a word, since he's got seven languages here, or six he's dealing with, and say that he might be righteous and the righteousifier of him too? No. And not of him, that's of the one. Ek? Which? What are you talking about? Ek, pisteos, or pisteos, Jesu, or Jesu. He translates that. Ek, which, pisteos, believeth, Jesu, in Jesus. Pisteos, Jesu, is, you already know this, a genitive. Ek, which, you know about which? Now, you can't go in modern linguistics much beyond Daniel B. Wallace's great study. Try to get on the book when I'm showing it. Greek grammar beyond the basics. Whole section on ek. Basic uses, genitive only. Has the force of from, out of, away from, of. In, which, I don't know where he's getting which. That's from out of nowhere. You can't even find that as a Sanskrit translation. In, basic uses, dative only. Here's the expansion of the multiple uses of ek. As a source, out of, from. As separation, spatially or otherwise, away from. In terms of time, a separating from or from this point on. As a causal force, because of. Partitive, of. As expressing means or instrumentality, by or from. There ain't no way you can get which or in out of ek. And yet, this brilliant scholar with more knowledge than all the people he's writing to, he just can't take them on. He has to go with tradition and translate the justifier of him which believeth in Jesus. There ain't no in there. That he might be shown to be righteous, and the righteous supplier of the ones out from, by means of, or of the faith of Jesus. This is why you need to listen to the teaching that's being done. I don't have to get anybody's approval but God's. And thanks be to God, the academic training and the PhD taught me to let the facts and the truth rule. I'm going to tell it to you after I exhaust every possible source. I'm going to tell it to you the way it is. You can't count on that. Even this brilliant scholar from whom I've learned much and will learn much more, he just couldn't break free from the traditions that make void the Word of God. This Christianity is of, out from, because of, by means of, the faith of Jesus. All we can do is reciprocate by trusting Him. All of our works mean nothing. For the next half hour, I have a little interesting sidelight, still in the realm of grammar. You couldn't buy this book from me, but it's a proof that even the best of them that are part of the institution have to sort of get along with their brothers. I'm glad, like Paul, I'm minded to go afoot. I walk alone with God. You follow me as I follow Christ, I'll take you home. And we're not any cult, and we're not doing any new revelation that's come to me. As F.B. Meyer said, all we need to do is rediscover the old truths that have been twisted and distorted by the best of the classical and traditional scholars. That's why I collect the manuscripts. We go to the source. Get on the phone. Without my permission today, I don't know if he was acting his head, I sure what, but the head usher or the usher, without my permission, handed out free today copies of the new pulpit. Now, surely my congregation knows that I do not lack the ability to say what I mean and mean what I say. I announced from the pulpit this morning that we had a new pulpit magazine that was up to my standards. If I had wanted them handed out, I know how to form that sentence. And I want to tell you today that as you leave the cathedral, the ushers will give you free copies. I never intended that. If you look at it, you who got it, it's got a $5 price tag on it. I intend to give that to you free. I don't know why that usher doesn't decide to start giving my cars away. Now, there is an old saying that if someone asks you, and not an old saying, Jesus said it, they ask you for your coat, give them your cloak also. But you've heard me teach. I learned it from Lionel Niebuhr. That only works in one-on-one relationship. Love is only workable one-on-one. You ask me for my coat, I'm to give you my cloak also. But if I'm carrying your coat, and somebody asks me for my coat, and I'm carrying your cloak, I don't have the right to improve my spiritual image in front of you by giving you the cloak also, because it ain't mine to give. In trying to express super love and look like a holy, wonderful, unselfish being, I steal your cloak. Now, I probably would have picked a particular Sunday when I knew enough in advance and said, for every person that's in the cathedral next time. I'm not saying that, because that right has been taken away from me. I probably would have picked a particular Sunday and said, for every person that's here next Sunday, I'm going to give you a copy of this pulpit. I'm not about to a King's House 540 that's been here for 30 years. Don't even try to write and say, I'd like a copy of the pulpit. Send $5, we'll send you one. I'm going to send you a copy of the pulpit. You've heard the resurrection message 30 times. That's designed for the people that are listening that don't have the opportunities you have here in Los Angeles. And had I, and I might still do it someday, but it's been robbed from me because you already have it. I might have said, for every person who comes to the cathedral next Sunday, I will give you a free copy. If you stand and give me a solemn pledge that you will find someone that you respect, because only somebody intelligent can appreciate this message on the resurrection. Find someone you respect, not some idiot, and you will give him this copy and say, this is my church, and this is for the church I go to, and this is my pastor. That would have made it beneficial to God and this work. But that usher cheapened this wonderful project. And of all the people on the face of the earth that should know it's worth more than $5 and would pay it, it's you. It's designed to be sent by those who listen. The messages I read here. My life's been changed. I never heard teaching like this before. I don't get teaching like this in my church. Send it to them to introduce the ministry. Followed, as I said, with a letter that says, don't put us in the tank with the rest of them. We don't want you on our mailing list, and this is not some trick to put you on our mailing list so we can descend on you with appeals for money. If you want to be on our mailing list because you appreciate the teaching, then you check this box and send it back. Weeks and months of planning was taken from me by a presumptuous former employee, old guard, volunteer, who is going to learn before he ever participates again how to recite Webster's Dictionary's definition of presumption. He can recite the first third of it, because in his brilliant mind, that's all he needed to know. And it's like water on a duck's back. It should have been clear to the congregation some time back that I've reached a level of zero tolerance with half-hearted Christianity and presumptuous old guard members of this church that think they don't have to grow anymore. It's very illustrative what's going on with the Lakers. I have people record the Laker games and the Lakers because it's a microcosm of what's wrong with the world today. Overpaid athletes. I hope that coach at Duke University has got enough brains and character to say no to $40 million and stay with the college kids that want to be taught and developed. The college is coming apart because you can't count on kids coming and staying with you 4 years because of the opening of the NBA draft to teenage kids, overpaid multimillionaire kids. Anybody coaching in the NBA is crazy. bought and paid for idiots. Anybody coaching in the NBA is crazy. You got a bunch of prima donna, $100 million contract players whose contract is firm. You can't fire them, you can't bench them, because the owner wants to charge what he charges for the seats, and the coach cannot. I mean, what a disaster is maybe the greatest coach in this age could no longer have the respect of his players to where they would cuss him out when he pulled them out as they went with the coach's bench, to where a player dares to say he's the general manager of the team, to where a player calls a coach before the general manager does and asks him, saying, I want you to come and coach me. That's the way this society is going. No respect for authority. Individual egomania, me-firstism. And like Henrietta Mears, who almost a century ago decried the fact that progressive education had taken over education in America, and she could live with that until shallow-headed Christian educators who didn't know the philosophy of experimentalism, which was anti-God, and that you can't separate the method from the philosophy. She decried the fact that it had taken over Christian education too. Now, this old dinosaur will not let society set the terms for the church. Jesus prayed for his church, as I preached this morning, and Jesus said what he wanted the church to become. And the church is a people that belong to him. And God gave some apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, not the other way around. So if you want a religious social club, get the bleep out of this church. If you want someone that will follow Christ with his whole being and his word, which is the way in which we have the roadmap of following him, then come follow me as I follow Christ, otherwise stay away. Now, I don't need some of the old guard that have gotten so comfortable that they decide that they can do just what Saul did, offer the sacrifice just as well as Samuel. And I don't need people making decisions when they don't have instructions to open an unopened box and give away things that have written on them $5 a piece that we paid a considerable fortune to get the first printing because we're 1,500 behind in the orders from new first-time callers around the nation to decide to hand them out free to my overfed congregation, half of whom are not paying tithe, 25% of whom, let's do it the other way, less than half of them are not paying tithe, and less than 25% will double portion in July, and somehow think that you're so good-looking and wonderful that I can't hardly stand it to not get there Sunday to talk to you. I'm talking to the world. You're lucky I let you in. So let's get it straight. And let's not wait until Wednesday to get the reservations in this week. And either get on board or get out. This is double portion month. And it will sort out the congregation with those that really care about being a part of this ministry. And if you don't, I don't care about being a part of your life. Is that straight enough?
Yes,
sir. Now get on the telephone. Come on now. I guess I want to show you after one more song, but there's enough phone calls coming in. I want you to keep it up. Reservations for Sunday. Secret 16. You're running out of time between now and Christmas. Commitments that you know you have to make during the month of July of double portioning. And a lot of you need to figure out there's too many thieves and robbers sitting in front of me on Sunday morning. That's what you are, a thief and a robber, and a bold one at that, because you talk about many security cameras on thieves and robbers. God doesn't need a mini cam to figure out that you're a thief and a robber. The tithe is the Lord's. Surely you've heard me teach enough to know I've exhausted that subject in God's Word, so I don't need anybody to give me their some amateurish idea that tithing is something in the law. No, Jesus said that you ought to have done. The reason there's not much about it in the New Testament, they gave 100%. It took a better understanding and the putting together of the canon to figure out that God doesn't want all that you have in the church. He has it already when He has you, but He wants to bless you and make you a steward of your own money where you are. The first tenth belong to Him. Not discussable. The tithe and the first fruits, the Lord's, if you hang on to it, you're a thief and a robber. How can you walk through the door of a church and sit down knowing that God knows you're a thief and a robber? Well, I can't afford it. Well, you can't afford not to. So you better figure out that as of today, on this significant day, 10% of what I have from this day forward belongs to God. Start doing it. And double portion this month what you did last month. If you either didn't do anything, that ought to be easy. Start tithing. Now get on the phone. I want all of you to pray. You came in a few minutes ago. You know our organist, Rick Boggs, we've been praying for him, for God to restore his sight. He's blind. Many of you probably remember when he was in ads all over Southern California on television. And now he's gotten a diagnosis of testicular cancer. I want you to pray for Rick. Make Rick a matter of your daily prayer. He's a vital part of our musical band on Sunday morning. Faithfully here, as a voice of faith, faithfully matriculating through his handicap. Pray for God to cure his blindness and do the same thing with his testicular cancer that he did with my prostate cancer. Amen. Drive those demons out and heal him. Amen. You make that a matter of prayer?
Yes, sir.
Again, this is sort of appreciation festival. You will have a little more understanding. Now, paradoxically, you're not needed. Paradoxically, if you don't have a right attitude, I'd rather you not show up. But you're absolutely needed if you come with a right attitude. And while I'm telling you that the illustration in a previous hour of the tentacles of traditional bondage that are on the best scholars, not since the Apostle Paul, not since Augustine, not since Martin Luther, has anybody cut loose from the traditions and the religious gang free to just do it God's way and damn the consequences. And even Luther could not free himself from his bondage to the church. That's why he could never deliver himself from transubstantiation as a doctrine at the table of the Lord. It's not easy to break free from traditions. I will be eternally grateful. My parents wanted me to go to Bible school. So if God was going to call me to preach, I would be ready. I studied when I was a teenager. I wore all the kids out in the neighborhood and would come home and cry because they all got tired and couldn't play any longer when I was a kid. So I went to Bible school before I went to college. Took 16 junior and senior units. And audited another 16. All I got out of it, it was new, was my first lessons in Greek. I'll be eternally grateful to Bill Pickthorne, the dean of the school, He was in trouble because I went home to help Dad on weekends and my grades made it incontestable. He said to me, "Gene, you're wasting your time here in Bible school. Go to college. I'll be eternally grateful." Then I got my training, finally in philosophy, from a professor that taught philosophy as philosophizing, as a function rather than the product of other men's thought. And he taught me how to think, or taught me the tools of right thinking. It's hard to throw off the shell of a seminary training. Philosophy undergirds religion. And I was able to spend the rest of my life on the theological side, having changed majors on every degree with the academic worldly disciplines. Did my PhD minor, a whole year's work in geography, when I discovered a loophole in their code that you could save a year's work and get your minor by requesting the department to test you in an oral exam. Nobody had ever tried or tested that rule. I applied for it. They knew I'd fail. So they let me have it, and I passed. That freed a whole year. At the most critical time, when Dr. Kishimoto was visiting from Tokyo University, the then world expert in Oriental religions. Studied under Spiegelberg, leading expert in Vedanta, ancient Indian religions. I've told you this before. His distinction was he had the largest collection in the world of Tibetan ghost traps. I'm eternally grateful that I got that background before I then found the most exciting pursuit of knowledge, God's Word. And when I tell you that I'm the only voice free to tell it the way it is, you make that possible. That's why I won't let you get some ownership position as though you're in any position to decide what God's going to tell me to do. You have freed me, and I have freed you. Let's leave it that way. But you get the credit, too, for this voice going around the world. So get busy and make your commitments. Get on the phone. Let me show you something. In the end of the previous half hour, and we're live, by the way. I don't care what time it is on your clock. It's live time here. Now, in the previous half hour, I was talking about, and the previous half hour before that, this, it's a great responsibility, which you could take off on a tangent. That's why probably at least 100 times over these 30 years I've quoted and did in the previous hour, F.B. Meyer, who said we don't need any new truths, we just need to rediscover the old truths. Paul didn't bring anything new. He just unfolded what had already been prophesied and written. He made clear what Jesus said to the couple on the Emmaus Road. Did you read the Law and the Prophets and Moses? They taught of me. I don't bring anything new. I just peel, like layers of the onion, the traditions off to get back through the manuscripts of the earliest, purest stream. Plenary inspiration. But we together are free. I set you free from the traditions that bind you until you in your life can work it out between you and God and recognize that everything that you do is the Lord's work. You are the Lord's. Your children are not yours. They're a gift from God. And you are a steward accountable to God for your parenting. Your marriage has a pattern in Ephesians 5 the husband to the wife what Jesus is to the church, the wife to the husband what the church is to the Lord. Your money's not your own, but you have a God who loves you. He wants you to recognize that all you have comes from Him. It's like He said to the Israelites before they ever got in Canaan. When you get over there and you prosper, remember who it is that gave you the power to get wealth. The tithe is a recognition of ownership. He takes a small part and then promises to bless you in many ways. He can control every dimension of your life. He can enter into all things, as Romans 8 says, and work it for good to them that are the called according to His purposes, and His purposes include the tithe. He don't need the money. He needs the recognition that He emptied the vault of heaven and paid the price for you. You acknowledge Him first with the first fruits and the tithe. And we're talking about offerings now. In July, we're asking people to double portion as an expression of gratitude for what the satellite, which makes possible all the ministry 24 hours a day. I'm not a fool. Most of the hours are just dead expense time. They're like a hospital or a fire station that's there when you need it. We don't look at the bottom line and say, what's this station bringing in? And then get on the air and say, if you don't send so much, we're going to have to cancel. You never heard me say that. I may get mad if you don't respond. Get on the phone, express some appreciation, and cancel for that reason. I look in the camera and say, don't send any money until I first teach you. Then make it worship. Worship is worth-ship. God watches while you make a testimony with your offering of what you think His Word taught to you by His gift minister is worth. You know, the Bible's very neat. It substitutes words. I'd like you to sit down someday and see how many minutes you can read in the Bible without an offering or a sacrifice being rendered. When you understand that offerings and sacrifices are the equivalent of taking up the offering in the church today, and God talking about money and giving more than about any other subject. When you love somebody, you have to restrain them from giving you everything they got. That's why God puts the limit. He wants the tithe. It's His. He wants sacrificial offerings as long as they are an expression of worship. He doesn't need money, and that's the only giving should be allowed in the church. But again, I'm talking about what it's easy for the Los Angeles congregation to take for granted. You take for granted. Some of you have never known a ministry other than me. You think, go to any church, this is what every church does. No, they have to consider first what other preachers and their denomination and the people they associate with and the groups they belong to will think about what they say. I don't care what God thinks. I don't even care what you think. I only care what God thinks. Now, you're surrounded by, the meditation room has priceless icons in it. You can't even get them from the part of the world they came from anymore. It's illegal. Wars have been fought. I brought the owner of one of the most famous restaurants out in Malibu, Tony's. Probably the best Greek restaurant in the Los Angeles basin. If you go, I think you'll agree. But Tony used to watch me down in Houston, and he's always very kind when we stop there sometimes en route north. And so I invited him to come and see the Bibles and see the icons. Next time I saw him, he saw some of the icons in the meditation room, and that's just a drop in the bucket with the icons that are in the prayer tower as we develop the cathedral tower. They're just a drop in the bucket in the meditation room. He said, do you know that nations have fought wars over just one of these? I remember the time that the Ukrainian Orthodox pastor who was building a new church up by Dodger Stadium, a friend, and visited the cathedral. You know, I find my friends not with the associates of the church that I grew up in that use me as an ex-wife. Though I've never kicked out of anything and I helped them become what they were. But I'd like you to know that what you see on religious television does not represent the body and soul of Christianity in America. If anything, it represents the extreme one-upmanship, super-spiritual, nutty fringe of Christianity. You may ask, why are you not on this biggest Christian network in the world? I wouldn't stoop to be seen 5 minutes on it. They just want you to know, none of these people have thrown me out. I just can't tolerate their self-righteous spiritual exploitism. The heart and soul of America is in pastors like my dad. 30 years in a little church, not the ones that bring their congregation to a big meeting in order to be seen on the platform. The day-to-day pastors in the thousands of churches across America. I'm sorry, there's going to be somebody in heaven other than Pentecostals. There really will be somebody in heaven other than Baptists. There really will be, to their amazement, since their word Catholic means the universal church, they will see some there that didn't wear their flag. This Ukrainian Orthodox pastor. I mean, Protestantism is but a branch off of Catholicism. Pentecostalism is but a branch off of Second Definite Work of Grace people. Do I believe in the glossolalia and Pentecost, and now it's more dignified to talk about charismatics? Sure. I can say with Paul, I speak in tongues more than you all, but and not the languages I've learned. That's between me and God, where it ought to be, not to be displayed in public. You're not even supposed to pray in public. Very little is known in the Western world of the Eastern Orthodox churches, of the first great schism that's separated most of the Middle Eastern churches. When the war was going on in Lebanon, not one out of a million Americans had a prayer of an idea of what they were saying when they were talking about the Maronite Christians in Lebanon. There's not one out of a million Christians in America that knows a single thing about the Thomistic Christians in India. They treasure some of the greatest biblical manuscripts dating back to the early days when Thomas founded that church on the coast of India. And the greatest proof that he died a martyr near Madras, India, is that he was pushing the frontier of Christianity into India. If it were just a legend, you can be sure that the grave of Thomas would be on the west coast of India, where the churches exist that point back to his founding. They would have kept it there if it was just a lie. He lost his life trying to push the gospel further into the interior of India. I've been there. I've seen the place. Western Christianity is totally ignorant of the Ethiopic church. Equally ignorant of the Coptic church. Know very little of the Armenian church. Thank God for the settlement in Glendale and the Armenians that have settled here. Most of the Christians don't even know about the Armenian genocide. 1,300,000 men, women, and children marched on a death march to their death by the young Turks that sided with the Kaiser in the First World War simply because they were Christians. The first Christian nation their alphabet conceived to enable the translation of the Bible. All they had up till then was Syriac scripture and some of the greatest treasures represent the collection of Armenian Bibles, again founded on the Syriac versions, primarily, not exclusively. This, back to the story, this Ukrainian Orthodox pastor asked me to come up and look at the new church he's building there, Dodger Stadium. And I get amused. You know, it's like a bunch of prostitutes on Sunset Strip thinking that because you're not socializing with them, you're an outcast. I happen to socialize with the established, respected Christians, not the nutty fringe that, because they have so much TV time, are making the world think that's the sum total of Christianity. I want you to know that the intelligent, historic churchmen of America have more respect for what I'm doing than they do the superior-minded, self-centered loudmouths that have dominated religious television, including one after another, the ones that topple. Maybe you read in the Times recently, another new scandal of a Ponzi scheme involving three of the most prominent ministries. Oh, they're squealing like stuck hogs. How dare, I'm outraged that church people have been taken advantage of. I'm going to give back. I'm going to give back the earnings that I got out of the scheme. I expect calls from some of them to ask me if I can help them get out of their mess. They always call me when they're in trouble. But then in public, they walk the other side of the street. Because I tell the truth, and they don't. But I want you to know there's a hard, solid backbone of faithful pastors across America that listen and respect the teaching that comes from this network around the world. So I visited this church for the Ukrainian pastor. Up in the Dakotas, there's a band of monks that produce their icons. That's all they can get. Can't take them out of other countries. Long before the restrictions came, and mostly via Israel, where Jews had taken icons with them as a means of capital as they started over in Israel. You don't comprehend the treasures that we have and make available for you every week. I talked last week about the group that are touring the country, invited by cities that Craig Lamp is now associated with in part, charging $15 a person to go and see a collection of Bibles that would disappear if we dropped them in the middle of our collection. There every Sunday for you and your family to learn the history of God's Word. And I happened to cut out of the LA Times an article, you can read the headline as the camera's turned on it. A spiritual icon returns to Russia. Full page article, tens of thousands lining up. You've got to commend the cleric in Chicago that returned it to the church in Russia. This icon is commanding thousands lining up to come and bow and pray and rejoice. This is why my friend Tony at the Tony's restaurant in Malibu said, "Do you realize that nations have fought wars over these?" Oh, the bliss of ignorance. Well, icons are idol worship. Well, that's what people thought until the iconographic controversy was settled at a church council. You don't worship the icon. It's a point of contact, a foci, that makes you, when you have intelligently studied and know what is from out of the Bible or the history of the church being pictured in the icon, it enables you to focus and look to that event. There's not an ounce of difference between a pictorial icon than a preacher who can tell the story of Abraham and his faith in a way that you visualize that that God saw in him and brought forth in him that he wants to see in us and bring forth in us. And that leads me to the idiocy of some missionaries and some translators when they go to cultures and try to figure out how we're going to translate the name of God. But I'm going to get to that in the next half hour as I show you the source of the word theos, the New Testament word. In the beginning was the Logos, that known intermediary between us and the unknown God. As the Logos said, namely Jesus, when you see me, you've seen God. He's the exegesis. He led him forth from behind a curtain. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with Ho Theos, the God. Where did that word Theos come from? That's the next half hour. Right now, you go to work. Get back on the telephone. You that are watching television, you're seeing a sunset filmed off of the porch of my parents' home on Lake Almanor up in Northern California. It's mine now, as they went to their reward. And I look at that, and I realize, you know, I could have left after the service today and go to bed there and wake up in the morning and sit on that porch and study. And here I am, sitting here trying to get you to be appreciative enough for the teaching and the ministry to get on telephone. About the next 5 minutes, I could still make it there by daylight. So you better get on the phone and let me know that you're glad for this 24-hour available ministry that you have and multiple media. It's your time to talk. And after the next song, I want to see every phone get busy. But after the next song, and I want to teach. Get on the phone. You know, I was commenting on Lake Almanor. That's just as pretty in the morning when you wake up and there's about 30 boats out there in what's called Banana Cove. It's the hottest fishing cove in that Rainbow Trout Lake that dammed up the headwaters of the North Fork of the Feather River. I grew up in that area. And then you see me driving with my wife through Quincy, one of the very first teaching missions. So many years ago, I was trying to count it. It'd be late 50s. That's a long time ago, isn't it? One of my first teaching missions in the day when teachers were not spiritual. Those were the Voice of Healing evangelist days. And one of my first teaching missions was in the little church, First Assembly of God there in Quincy, California. And you may remember Don North and Pete North visiting from Orville so many times in the recent years. His father, Don's father's Pete, who was serving him, and Pete North's father was the pastor in Quincy. That brings back good memories. And just to think I could be almost within spitting distance on this holiday weekend if I had left after church and gone up there. In fact, I had to have one of the locals that looks out for me up there go over and protect my dock from all the tourists that descend on that lake. Not DOC, but DOCK. Because Dad was there before anyone else, we got grandfather clauses for the largest dock on the lake. I don't want a bunch of drunken tourists getting in my boat and polluting my dock, so I have somebody up there to tell them goodbye. Save for later time. Take your seat. Don't call anymore. (Clears throat) I have insatiable appetite for knowledge and anything that can broaden an understanding of God's Word. Here's a very rare copy of, I'll find the cover page. I'll show it to you. The suspense is killing. Ah, come on. I'll find it. Just hold on. We own this time. Do not be nervous. Here it is. I don't know if you can pick it up on the camera or not, but let's try. This is, again, the real scholars were a generation ago. This generation is more interested in science and special effects and movies. The Edinburgh Review from Edinburgh, Scotland. You know, I have people searching all the time to find things for me. The Edinburgh Review, October 1851. A comparative grammar of Sanskrit, Zend, Greek, Latin, Lithuanian, Gothic, German, and Slavonic languages by Professor F. Bopp. And of course, Hollywood would change his name. Professor F. Bopp. Comparative philology is a science of very modern date. It cannot trace its lineage much higher than the beginning of the present century. And it is scarcely received as yet on a footing of equality with the elder branches of learning. Classical philology, in particular, as if afraid of the charms of a younger sister, has for a long time treated comparative philology with a kind of supercilious pride, and in several cases the hostile feeling of the two rivals has vented itself in open feuds and quarrels. And with that, he takes off on this comparative philology. Now, so many things in the history of American Christianity went on underneath those giant Jesus Save signs that we treasure, that every time I step to the platform, I am aware that over me are those Jesus Save signs, under which every great preacher in America and some from around the world preached. G. Campbell Morgan taught under those signs in his senior years. Billy Sunday, Billy Graham, J. Vernon McGee, R. A. Torrey, first pastor there. You go down 6th Street and turn on Hope Street, which dead ends at the Central Library, and go, as you park and turn, go to the right at the circle. There's Hope Street dead ends there. It doesn't reach to 5th. There's a historic marker there in memory of the famous Church of the Open Door. And it lists the pastors from R.A. Torrey to the last pastor to preach in that building, Dr. Gene Scott. I was able to save the Jesus Save signs and get them declared a historic monument, and got permission to wed the historic monument of the cathedral with those signs and move them to the top of the cathedral to preserve them on the skyline of Los Angeles. Fundamentalists go down there and there's a little rug, or used to be, and they move the rug to cover my name. But they don't like to see me as the last. They just list the pastors, starting with R.A. Torrey through J. Vernon McGee, Dr. Gene Scott, the last one. I take great pleasure in that. You know, it's amazing how some of the super spiritual ones in Los Angeles go there and lose their spirituality completely. One of the things that started under those signs, and by the way, as a footnote on the Ukrainian Orthodox pastor I talked of in a previous half hour, he held some of those icons that are in the meditation room off from the room of the book at the cathedral and just wept. Just sat there and wept. Because he could never get icons like that for the new church up by Dodger Stadium. Also, under those signs, the Wycliffe Bible Society started. A missionary effort that would send missionaries to native tribes that had no written language. And they would stay with the tribe until they learned the language. And then they would, having learned the language, reduce it to a written alphabet and translate. And usually this began with phonetic type alphabet. And then they would translate the scripture into a tongue that had never been written before. If you check past festivals on our book and tape list, way back, I spent several weeks going through a little book that outlined their most difficult biblical words that they encountered the greatest difficulty in translating into the indigenous language wherever they were translating. One of the words that's always a problem is you will encounter in every culture a name for God, sometimes names for many gods, but there's always a supreme one. Now, you may recall as I was writing on the board and translating one of the verses in Romans, the Ethiopic word for God, which was strange, Exiebker. It was an ancient name in Ethiopic for the Lord of the land, the owner of everything. And when they went into the Ethiopic language, they didn't try to bring a cognate over and introduce a new name for God. They took the name that was there, Exiebker. And that's the name of God. Now, of course, one of the problems they face is because that in the ancient culture of the language, if you assume the biblical truth that we all come from Adam, and then secondarily through the Shemite family of Noah, or rather the Sethite family of Noah, then a splitting of the family through Noah, and the Shemites are just one third of the stream, Japheth and Ham being the other two. But if you assume the beginnings in Adam, you always come at a crossroad in philosophy. Philosophers tell you because archaeology has uncovered similar flood stories. Every culture has creation stories, flood stories, that all the Jews did was borrow from existing myths and put their own stamp on it. However, there's an alternative, and neither one can be proven. The alternative is all cultures have a common root, and in the memory bank of every culture are common denominators of what they call the creation myth and the flood myth, etc. And God decided, as he always did, to choose out a people, the high priestly family through Seth. He starts over with Noah and his sons. But in every culture, there is this common memory bank of a God who created, a God who became angry and destroyed the earth, and his choice of survivors. You've got the alternative choice that God decided through these chosen people, his oracles, to preserve the true record, while all the other cultures could build on their memory bank and fantasize and enlarge and exaggerate. So neither one borrowed from the other. They have a common source, except one was under the control of a director, God. The other cultures were out of control and elaborating and exaggerating out of their seed common knowledge of things common to all mankind. I choose the latter. I work back from the resurrection. Jesus, who he claimed to be, and his use of Genesis puts the stamp on that. But when you go into these cultures, you're going to find that what started out as a common understanding of a supreme God, and there were always angels, Elohim. In fact, Elohim said, "Let us make man in our image." And no one has developed in their so-called monotheism, no one has developed an angelology and a demonology, a hierarchy of angels and demons underneath the one God, more than the Jews. Read the Apocryphal Book of Enoch and you get them all spelled out. Most of what man knows comes from these. So when you encounter in a culture a name of God that is dominant in that culture, even though there may be multiple other lesser gods, doesn't necessarily mean that that name, if you trace it back to the oldest root in the particular culture, did not start out right. God says it clear in Romans. Man begins, instead of recognizing and practicing awareness of the intelligence behind it all and the supreme God, they begin to worship the creature instead of the creation. So what was God Almighty in the earliest roots of mankind gets identified with parts of his creation. So sometimes missionaries, instead of shying away from the name of whatever supreme God among the many gods that the culture has, need to cleanse that original name and go ahead and use it, because they all know the supreme God. Let me read a little of this article. There's an old root in the Sanskrit. Now, all the Indo-European languages flow from the Aryans through the Sanskrit. There's an old root in the Sanskrit, div. Write D-I-V on a piece of paper. To shine, that's what it means. To shine, which according to a general rule of Sanskrit grammar, and, you know, this is true when you move into many of the Semitic languages, you'll get confused because when a certain letter is followed by another letter, you change the letter. And all of a sudden, you are seeing an end in the place of something else that was there. Sanskrit's like that. The root may be div, to anglicize it, which according to a general rule of Sanskrit grammar, may be changed to dyu, you. From this root comes the Greek word Zeus, which by a regular transition of letters is nothing but the root du, dyu, or yu, with the s of the nominative, and corresponds therefore exactly to the Sanskrit dyaus, dyaus. The Greek language, how many of you Latinos here know the difference between the way Castilian Spanish and Mexican Spanish and other Latin Spanish vary in the pronunciation of the D, whether soft or hard? And for an Englishman, you'd write TH instead of D, the way some of them pronounce it. Same way here. The Greek language does not admit of two such consonants as DY at the beginning of a word. So you're bringing D-Y-A-U-S into the Greek, and Greek does not allow a word to start with D-Y. Thus, it sometimes dropped the first, sometimes the second letter. Dropping the Y, you get the Greek form, Deus, D-E-U-S, which according to ancient authorities was used instead of Zeus. And when the D began to be pronounced like a Z, the initial D is likewise preserved in the accusative Dia, D-I-A. Dropping the first letter, you still writing along with me? Dropping the first letter, the Sanskrit Y is regularly changed into the Greek Z. Like Sanskrit huge. Sanskrit Yava is Greek Zia. So that Zeus may indeed be considered as the Greek pronunciation of the Sanskrit Yaus. The Greek Zeus, Z-E-U-S, may indeed be considered as the Greek pronunciation of the Sanskrit Yaus, Y-A-U-S, and the developed pronunciation of Deus, D-E-U-S. So it goes from the Sanskrit through Old Greek Deus to more modern Greek Zeus. So that Zeus may indeed be considered as the Greek pronunciation of the Sanskrit Yaus, Y-A-U-S. In Latin, there is no nominative like Jos. And I can go on a side road here and say, we encountered the Hebrew word Yahweh, which by the time it reaches the modern world, they didn't pronounce it. When the Masoretes put the vowel signals under the letters, because they erroneously, this is how the devil is able to twist things in the minds of men. God said to Moses, by my name, Yahweh, Yod, He, Vav, He, four letters, four consonants, the tetragrammaton. He said, by this name, I'm going to reveal myself to you. The rabbis turned it around, pushed it back into the no-no land, they're not supposed to know or pronounce it. And since Yahweh appears in their Torah scrolls, when the Masoretes got around to putting the vowel points to tell you how to pronounce it, they took the vowel points for the word Adonai and put the vowel points for Adonai under Yahweh, which makes it unpronounceable. You can't pronounce Yahweh the way the vowel points are, because you're not supposed to. When you come to it, the vowel points are to remind you you're supposed to read Adonai, not Yahweh, because that's too holy a name to pronounce. By the time the Protestants began to work with it, not afraid to pronounce it, we have a horse, for example, named Waldera. To us, we had it. She's gone on to horse heaven. But Waldera is spelled W-A-L-D-E-R-A, but the German doesn't allow you to pronounce the W as wa. It's va. So the proper pronunciation of the horse that was a German warm blood, and thus, or Dutch warm blood, and thus named in the German context, was properly pronounced Waldera. But I've never found a redneck horse show announcer that could know that. It's always Walderas out there jumping when the registration papers to any good German, like Luther knows, it's Waldera jumping that fence. Likewise, they pronounced the Y with a J. So we have the Yod is Ja, or Je, and the He is Ha, and the Vav or Wav, you go to various Hebrew grammar, depending on the German influence or the more ancient Hebrew, that is the consonant for V or for W. But for the Germans, the W is pronounced like a V, so it couldn't be Jehovah or Yahweh, so it had to be Jehovah, Jehovah. And we get then Jehovah. And by coming through the German, we get Jehovah. Go behind the German, it's Yahweh. Yahweh. That's because not every language has the ability to pronounce, that's my problem with the French, to pronounce the letters common to a particular language. And when I study the Coptic, I have to deal with 6 or 7 demotic letters that have sounds that are not duplicated in any of the other languages that I study. I remember when I went to Korea as the first teacher at Choyeonji's church, he was just the assistant then and was my interpreter in Seoul, Korea. Sounded like he's coughing most of the time while he's translating. They had sounds, and we still don't know whether to call the poor dead guy Ayatollah, whether he's Khomeini or Khomeini, because we don't know how to say that coughing sound. I mean, I have a friend who's his uncle was the president of Syria, and he keeps trying to teach me how to get a sound out of the back of my throat for that same sound in Arabic. It's like, I can't, you know, and so I can't do it. That's what's happening here. The Zeus is the Greek pronunciation of the Sanskrit Yaus. In Latin, there's no nominative like Jos, which would be the Latin form corresponding to the Sanskrit. And if you want me to continue, get on the phone, I'll be. Well, we're live. We've been live for hours. Where you been? And I'm addressing the folks on Channel 56 in Los Angeles. It's holiday weekend. Everybody should have taken their holiday and been in the cathedral today. Some were and are glad they were there instead of fighting the traffic between here and Las Vegas or some other such place. And since we've been here for hours, you're coming into the middle of something I'm already teaching on. So I don't want you to call. Don't want anybody to do anything but sit down and listen. And I'm reading from 1859 or 57. I got to find it again. The Edinburgh Review. Earlier, October 1851. The comparative grammar of the Sanskrit, Zend, Greek, Latin, Lithuanian, Gothic, German, and Slavonic languages. What better holiday activity could you be involved in than being taught about a comparative grammar of the Sanskrit, Zend, Greek, Latin, Lithuanian, Gothic, German, and Slavonic languages? The subject matter is the difficulty that missionaries have had in figuring out, as they translate the Bible, whether to use a name for God that is already existing in the language that they are moving into, which is most of the time tinged with idol worship and a reduction of what in their historic memory bank was. And there are lots of studies on this, that when you go into the earliest roots of most cultures, all of them begin with an idea of a supreme God, not identified with any part of the creation, like the sun god or a mountain god or a wind god or a storm god. In the earliest roots, they had a name for a supreme being over it all. But because that name in many cultures has been reduced down to some part of the creation, shouldn't surprise us, because Paul in Romans 1 condemns the fact that men have begun to worship the creation instead of the Creator. And I'm concentrating on this study just one word, because always a battle for missionaries, and that's the New Testament word in the Greek language for God. Now, I preached on the names of God in the Old Testament. In the Hebrew, there's Yahweh, but they can't pronounce it. It's too holy to name. So they fool you. They put the vowel points for Adonai. And in the King James, when you see Lord in capital letters in the Old Testament, that's Yahweh. Or as the Germans reduced it and twisted it, and we inherited it, to Jehovah. Yahweh. And then there's El, God Most High. And then there's added names to El and added names to Yahweh. And then out of these multiple names, it's reduced to just one God, even though in the plural, Elohim said, "Let us make man in our image." The New Testament chooses for Yahweh, Theos. Where'd that name come from? And that's what we're reading about. Got to skip it a little bit to catch up those who just joined us. There's an old root in Sanskrit. This will help you correct your notes again. And anglicize, D-I-V, which means to shine. Write that down and remember, Sanskrit, that ancient language in India through which the Aryan tribes matriculated and most of the Indo-European languages which we in the Western world speak, are branches off of that root and that tree. The old root in Sanskrit, D-I-V, means to shine, which according to a general rule of Sanskrit grammar, may be changed into D-Y-U. From this root comes the Greek word Zeus, which by regular transition of letters is nothing but the root D-Y-U or Y-U with the S of the nominative and corresponds, therefore, exactly to the Sanskrit Dios. The Greek language, however, doesn't allow two such consonants as D-Y at the beginning of a word. I thought I got my pages mixed up. You can't use in the Greek D-Y to begin a word. So sometimes it is dropped the first, the D, and sometimes the second letter, the Y. Dropping the Y, we get the Greek form of deus, D-E-U-S, which according to ancient authorities was used instead of Zeus. But to skip along later, Z takes the place of the D, and thus, dropping the D of the Sanskrit yaus, Y-A-U-S, becomes in the Greek Z-E-U-S. In Latin, there is no nominative like Jos. Spanish would say Jos. Well, I remember as a boy, first time my mother taken me somewhere and read the sign to San Jose. Anybody knows that's J-O-S-E is San Jose, not San Jose. Anybody knows Paso Robles is Paso Robles, not Paso Robles? In Latin, there's no nominative like Jos, which would be the Latin form corresponding to the Sanskrit Dios. But the old word reappears in the oblique cases where we have Jovim. Other words like Dispater and Dispiter show that like the Greek and Sanskrit, the Latin also knew both forms of the ancient root. The corresponding words in the Old German are Zio and Tius, Z-I-O and T-I-U-S. One of our old heathen gods, now long forgotten, but whose name still lives in the name of Tuesday. Just think of it. If you were born on Tuesday, that's Tuesday. It had generally been supposed that the Sanskrit language and religion did not know Dyaus, D-Y-A-U-S, as a god. But that Dyaus in Sanskrit as a feminine was used only for heaven and sky. Yet, if we examine the Sanskrit in its oldest form, as we find it in the Veda, or Veda, the oldest Vedanta scripture, traces can still be discerned proving the former existence of a god, Dyaus, D-Y-A-U-S. It is true that in the commentaries on the Veda, their scripture and their basket of scriptures, Diaus, D-Y-A-U-S, is always explained. Am I boring you? Diaus is always explained by the resplendent sky. But it may be observed in the hymns of the Veda, ancient, passed on orally, that the word Diaus, which is a feminine, is sometimes used as a masculine. And in these cases, it always means the god Diaus, D-Y-A-U-S. Thus, we read in the Rig Veda, quote, "When the pious man offers his morning libation to the great father Diaus, he trembles all over as he becomes aware that the archer sent forth from his mighty bow the bright dart that reaches him, and brilliant himself gave his own splendor unto his daughter the dawn." Moreover, Aurora is frequently called Duhita Deva, which is usually translated by the daughter of the sky, but according to the principles of mythology, she cannot be the daughter of the sky. She is produced by the sun from the night, and therefore she is the daughter of the night and of the sun, that is to say, of the god Diaus. Although then to the Indian mind the name of the god Diaus was lost already at an early period because his name had become the usual word for sky, as in the Latin sub dio, and because poets and priests soon introduced other names for this deity as Agni, Indra, Mitra, and the like, yet we see that he was once known under his old Aryan name in India, and thus we arrive at a result which flashes like the sudden ray of light through the dark world of the first mythological ideas among the Aryan nations. We see that before their separation took place, they had a name for a god, that's before the Aryans separated into tribes, expressive of the brilliancy of the sun, the sky, and daylight, that they called him Diaus and the Great Father. We see that Zeus was not an invention of Homer, that Jupiter was not borrowed from Greece, but that long before the Aryans immigrated into Greece and Italy, they had worshipped the same god under the same name, and that the Brahmins who migrated toward the south invoked him along the rivers of the Punjab, and that the Teutonic nations proceeding toward the north celebrated the same god on the mountains of Scandinavia. Diaus, listen, as the name, and remember the root in the Sanskrit? What's it mean? To shine. Where I put it. D-Y-U, to shine. Diaus is the name of the old Aryan god, means light. But not light in its abstract sense, not as a feminine or a neuter, but as a masculine, as the shining sun, the bringer of light and life. It was a happy thought of the sons of nature who first raised their eyes up to heaven to perceive there, high above them, in their simplicity, probably assuming a flat earth, high above them the brilliant manifestation of a divine power, and it was a happy grasp of language to express the awful feeling of the existence of a divine power by a word which meant light. That's what the Shekinah is. That's what glory means. Had I pursued John 17 a little more today in his prayer, there was a glory that Jesus had, clothed in power and light. The Hebrew word, kabodik. Moses, let me see your kabodik. You look on me, you'll die. You're not able to handle. Hide in the cleft of the rock. He hit him there, passed by, just saw the backside. And for days when he came from the mountain, his own face so glowed that he had to wear a veil. Jesus stepped out from that in the kerygma, in his humiliation. He left that enmeshed in glory and power and light, and moved into a tent of human flesh. But he still had the glory of God's nature within him, and that glory he attempted to pass on, demonstrate, and declare. But in his prayer he says to God in John 17, "Restore to me the glory I had before I came here." Do you understand? I'm no weirdo. I lost my faith. PhD in philosophy of education at Stanford. Came back from a hard study of the resurrection. But once I settled that and traced the appearances of God in the Old Testament and the Shekinah, which is just light settling on whatever his form and whatever I defined circumstance today as two Latin words, circum, and that means what surrounds, and stare, which is to stand. What stands around us? What stands around God and what stands around Jesus in his previous glory? That encasement, that circumstance of glory, he left or emptied himself out from. And he brought with him the divine nature of God that conceived him and was indwelt in him and empowered him for his task. And now in John 17, he's praying to be restored to that circumstance of the surrounding doxa, as the Greek has it. He prayed that we would be with him in the place that he is and have that surrounding also. I mean, you wonder how that angels will be spoken of or are spoken of in the ages to come as our footstools, as this walk of faith is the preparation time for us to be brought into the family of God and the Spirit of God that comes within us. One day will lift us to be with him through death or the rapture at the resurrection day. And we will be surrounded with that glory. Boy, what some people call glory is a cheap imitation. That's our blessed hope. That's our destiny. As we follow the pattern of the faith of Christ and learn down here in training to rule and reign throughout eternity. But light, that's common to the Old Testament as that which is the circumstance or surrounding stand that which stands around God. They did what Romans 1 says. To them, the most brilliant light they faced, the most brilliant light they encountered, and inheriting from an ancient knowledge of God, from the beginnings and the common roots of mankind, they and their separation from God and no longer as Adam and Eve able to talk to him every day and be instructed. They take the ancient name of God and stamp it on the brightest light in the sky and then stamp it on subsidiary lights in the sky like the moon and stars. But in their most ancient understandings, Deus was light. That's all they could see. They can't see through the light. Deus is the name of the old Aryan god, means light. It was the light of the sun by which men were awakened every morning from the sleep of the night, and with the setting of the sun, their own life faded away into unconscious slumber. That brilliant globe whence they received light and warmth, the silent majesty of whose daily course the clear atmosphere of the Himalayan regions permitted them to witness, must have excited the feeling of devotion in every human heart. And although the poetic genius of men may have perceived afterwards the active presence of a divine power in other forms of nature, from no other source could it have beamed with greater splendor. If then, as we cannot doubt, The consciousness of God was latent in the hearts of men, all men, like a veiled remembrance of a former world. It was the power of the sun that pierced and lifted the veil and thus brought the idea of God into specificity and its brightness before the eyes of the heathens. How natural that the name of the revealer should have been given to that which he revealed, and that the sun by which the glory of God became first manifest in this world to the senses of men should have been taken as a manifestation of God himself. Nothing in their world, in this world, could have been nearer, no image worthier to represent and express God than the sun. And it shows the existence of a transcendental power in the mind of these early worshipers that they looked for their God not in the world around them, which they could touch and grasp, fetishism, but up to that world which one sense only, and that the highest, presented to the mind's eye. What we've here said, however, would only prove that the Aryan nations possessed some of their mythological gods in common, but it would not enable us to affirm that they had also felt the want of an expression for the simpler and purer ideas of God in those early times, when they still were connected by the bonds of a common language and of a common faith. In order to prove this, we must take into account another class of common Aryan words, formed by the same root, D-I-V, div, or rather D-I-U. Yeah, D-I-U, by means of a derivative, which gives to these words a more general and abstract meaning. Now it's D-I-V. Yeah, D-I-V. These words are Deva in Sanskrit. I can't read whether this is U or V. And it's written in English, so I don't know what letter would be in Sanskrit. Dua, that's it. Dua in Sanskrit, it's U. Dios in Greek. Deus in Latin. Divas in Lithuanian. Divas. Diva, which means originally bright, brilliant, divine, expresses a quality equally ascribable to all the different forms and names of God that have arisen out of the individualizing spirit of language, and it adopted itself, therefore, most easily and naturally to express the general, essential idea of God, godly, divine. This was already the case in the Veda. Although the transparency of the Vedic language permits, in most cases, the original meaning of the word Deva, that of brilliancy, to shine through. Deva, to shine through, whether, for instance, the old poets meant to say the divine aurora or the brilliant dawn by calling Ushas, as well as her rays, Dua, or Dewi, must remain doubtful in many passages. In Greek and Latin, however, Dios and Deus are neither attribute nor name of God, but they have really become the word for God, expressing at once the abstract idea of the philosopher and the poetical image of the old barbs, or bards, and the breathing creation of the sculpture. Now, I've only begun. I've found all these grammar books, and the next language I'm tackling is Sanskrit. I think the Sanskrit will be easier than trying to read this English, where nobody can tell the difference between D-I-V and D-I-U here. It's one of those V normally. These. Now you use. Is that the way you write it? Hand this to Ed there. I'm going to circle it. And find a pencil. One of you cameramen, get loose from your connections. Get over here. Come on, let the singer come over here. The piano player. Get over here, quickly. Let's take three votes. Take that to Ed and tell me whether that's D-I-U or D-I-V. Go there. You tell me before you give it to Ed. Get a camera on him. Look at him. Is that D-I-U or D-I-V, Mr. Piano Player? Huh?
D-I-V.
What is it, Ed?
D-I-V, sir.
Yeah, well, you're all wrong. Let's give it to Pastor Folker. What's it say, Pastor Folker? Is that D-I-U or D-I-V?
D-I-V.
Yeah, well, that's what I said first, wasn't it? Now, I can tell you the next time I read this, I will be in my Sanskrit grammar book. That's my next challenge. I had to wrestle. Am I going to take Georgian? And I said, no, my wife speaks Russian and Yugoslav, so I'll let her tackle that side of it first, because they're similar languages. So I decided I won't be translating the New Testament Romans into Sanskrit, because I don't yet know anybody that translated it back into Sanskrit, because who would read it? I mean, there was a time when people were reading and needed to be able to read the Gospels in Persian and Arabic and Ethiopic. But because of its foundational grammar and root words for so many of the languages I'm having to work with, that's my challenge for the next few months, is to learn Sanskrit. Obviously, I don't know Sanskrit now. I'm reading this guy here. Deva, Deus, and Deus. But I just found a key. Ha ha. Look here. I got Deva, Theos, and Deus. And Deus happens to have a U in it. And it's got the with a tail on it. So that's how I know that's a U. And Deva's a U without a tail. But I don't care what anybody, you three philologists. And that was my first one, was Deva, D-I-V. But then I kept seeing that curve at the bottom, that must be a U. But now I see, take this, where are you? You keep running away at the end of prayer because you can't see. I saw you holding it like this. You read at the top, you can see, for the particular typewriter this guy was using in 1851, he's got a tail on the U on Deuce there, see?
Yes,
that's how you can tell.
Yes,
I mean, it's a major discovery we've made here tonight. Go show that to Pastor Folker. You can clearly see. Look at the U. Yeah, right? Got a tail on the U. And the V is a U without a tail. Nobody should write a V like that. You write a V like a... It's got a V. It's got a V. And don't any of you carnal people start going wrong directions. I have to read this again now that I know it's a V and not a U. Let's start over again. Am I boring you? I think I might be. You get on the phone if you want me to continue. Otherwise, now that we've solved the V and the U, and I haven't even got to the reason why the Theos was chosen, I'll just quit. I mean, with one major discovery here, that's enough for one night. Get on the telephone if you want me to continue. Well, the phones are pretty busy, and that suggests you want me to continue. But I want to give you the time to make reservations for the Cathedral Sunday. We're starting double portion month. That has no meaning to anyone except my congregation, and they know what it is. So I'm telling you, the month is upon us, and that double portion that is our way of reminding ourselves of what 21 years ago, this is the anniversary Sunday of our going on satellite 21 years ago, and you that know what double portion is and what it means, get your commitments in right now. Just use the phone for another song, and I'll return to this. Well, now, if you just joined us, I'm digging into Sanskrit. My problem is not the Sanskrit. I've already told you, I don't read Sanskrit. I've made it my business to learn a new language each year. And finally, at 75, which will be my birthday next month, you better start getting ready for birthday Sunday, August 15th. August 15th. Remember? How many of you remember on Golden Pond? That movie.
Yes, sir.
No, what's his name, the old man? Henry Fonda. And who's the woman, that classic old Katharine Hepburn with a squeaky voice? And she's telling him he's feeling bad because he's so old and he gets lost in the woods and he's grumbling and complaining, and she says to him, "You're not old, you're middle-aged." And he said, "What do you mean middle-aged? Nobody lives to be 140. Except me. I'm going to have my middle-aged birthday, 75, on August 14th. You've all watched it and witnessed it since my healing from cancer with no surgery, no radiation, no pills. I don't take pills. Not against pills, just don't take them. Isn't that the silliest thing you ever saw, that ad for Viagra with these ugly guys that no matter what their parts might do, anybody that would go to bed with them's crazy. And they're coming out and jumping, and one old fat, ballooned-up guy's doing his Elvis Presley pelvic movements, and they're all so happy because of Viagra. Thank God he's preserved me from that. But I'm telling you, I mean, I'm not against pills, but since God heal me, you've watched, I get younger every day. 75, going strong, August 15th. You better make that Super Sunday. And I like gifts. That's what I like about birthday. Birthday's one, I don't like Christmas, you've got to exchange gifts. I like birthdays. But, you know, in addition, I was smart. I got married on the 13th. So Friday the 13th is my anniversary, so I never forget it. And Friday the 14th, Saturday the 14th is my birthday. And Sunday's birthday Sunday. It's just the middle of my birthday month, which is only less than 30 days away. You remember that? Sit down, everybody. I'm going to start teaching. Well, I like this message. Pastor, I always thought it was me when those Roman arches would carve MVSEVM. For museum instead of M-U-S-E-U-M. Those V's and U's would get me every time. Now, I'm telling you, I made it my business to learn a language a year. Didn't take a year on the Italian. My wife's just teaching me that. That's continuous. But this is my year. Finally, I'm digging back through the languages that I'm going to tackle Sanskrit. Not because I will accumulate manuscripts that have Bible translations in Sanskrit, but because it's like those who've learned Greek and Latin find so many common words in the Romance languages and in English, because we have so many words that came out of that. But more importantly, the grammar of Sanskrit is the foundation of most of the Indo-European languages. So I don't read Sanskrit yet, but I just showed you a picture from one of the many grammars I've been accumulating. That's my challenge for my 75th year. So my problem on reading this article is not I can't read Sanskrit, it's I can't read the English they're writing down here. And we finally figured out on this 1851 printing the difference between their U's and their V's. They're absolutely the same, except the V has a little curl at the top instead of a post and back down with a tail. Now that we got that, I'm going to read this again. We're tracing the source of the word Theos in the Greek. In order to prove this, we must take into account another class of common Aryan words formed by the same root, D-I-V. We got that straight now, haven't we?
Yes, sir.
Versus where we started with the other word, which is D-Y-U. Now, I had no trouble with that U, with D-Y-U, is when I got to this silly V. D-Y-U, which simply means to shine. The basis of Deus that became Zeus. And many other languages that have borrowed from Theos or Zeus for God. Div, D-I-V, by means of a derivative, which gives to these words a more general and abstract meaning. These words are Deva in Sanskrit. Theos in Greek. And I'm sure that some of you know the languages that you have to learn, whether you pronounce the D with a th, T-H sound, or with the hard D sound. Div, Deva in Sanskrit, Theos, or Theos in Greek, Deus in Latin, Divas in Lithuanian, Deva, which means originally, as contrasted with Deo, which is shine, bright, brilliant, divine, expresses a quality equally ascribable to all the different forms and names of God that have risen out of the individualizing spirit of language. He gets pretty poetic here. I'm going to skip through that. It adopted itself most easily and naturally to express the general and essential idea of God, godly, divine. This is already the case in the Veda, the ancient Vedanta scripture. In India, although the transparency of the Vedic language permits in most cases the original meaning of the word Deva, that of brilliancy, on the diamond of language, a little different way of talking about light, to shine, in this case brilliancy, to shine through. Whether, for instance, the old poets meant to say the divine aurora or the brilliant dawn, by calling Ushas, the aurora, as well as her rays, Divi, must remain doubtful in many passages. In Greek and Latin, however, Theos and Deus are neither attribute nor name of God, but they have really become the word for God, expressing at once the abstract idea of the philosopher, the poetical image of the old bards, and the breathing creation of the sculptor. We see thus that from the word Deva, by which in the course of time language seems to have recovered the idea of God, was derived from the same root div, D-I-V, from which those other words had arisen, by which language had failed at first to express the same idea, Deus, Zeus, etc. We also see that this second step must have been made before the Indo-European separation of the Aryan tribes. And now that generation after generations have passed away with their languages, adoring and worshiping the name of God, preaching and dying in the name of God, thinking and meditating over the name of God, there the old word stands still as the most ancient monument of the human race in the most ancient language that we know of on earth, so I might question that because of the brilliant finds in Linear A and Linear B in Crete. But it breathes to us the pure air of the dawn of humanity, carrying with it the thoughts and sighs, the doubts and tears of our bygone brethren, and still rising up with the same sound from the basilicas of Rome, the temples of Benares, as if embracing by its simple spell millions and millions of hearts in their longing desire to give utterance to the unutterable, to express the inexpressible. It may be seen from this single instance, that comparative grammar addresses itself not only to the grammarian, but to the philosopher and the historian also. It has opened a new and safe path through the forest hitherto impervious, and it is now for other sciences to follow and to gather with a careful hand the fruits which are brought within their reach. And what's the relevance to what I do and teach? As I said, under the Jesus Saves signs at the cathedral, the Wycliffe Bible translators started. Always encountering a name for God, usually a supreme God, bearing a name, and as I've already said earlier tonight, you'll remember, they kept it in the Ethiopian language. Their word for God, translated as they translate the scriptures, when they translate Theos, it's Exiabker, which is Lord, in its ancient meaning, Lord of all the land. He truly is. Instead of abandoning the name of the supreme God that's in the ancient roots of every culture, they should have done what Paul did when he came to Mars Hill. And they had a monument to the unknown God. They should have stripped the name of God and convinced the people that its more ancient meaning was not identified with the sun. That's worshiping the creature instead of the creator who created the sun. But we now have across cultures all kinds of strange new names that cannot really hold the people because ingrained in their nature is that God-given awareness there is a supreme being and they already have a name for it. Let me give you an illustration of the mistake. These pages, the author says, were all but struck off before we had seen a most interesting pamphlet by Sir George Staunton. Quote, "An inquiry into the proper mode of rendering the word God and translating the sacred scriptures into the Chinese language." My wife speaks one, but I don't speak the Chinese language. "Although it refers to a country with which, as far as we know, the Aryan tribes have had no connection in language or history, it offers the most striking parallel with regard to the progress of language and its influence on the human mind among the Chinese and the Indo-European nations. There has been a long controversy between the different sects of Christian missionaries as the best way of rendering the word God into Chinese. The first preachers of the gospel who visited China without scruple, the first preachers of the gospel who visited China accepted without scruple the Chinese words Tian and Shangti." And I'm not a speaker of Chinese, so I don't know whether it should be Shangti or Shangti. But the spelling T-I-E-N and Shangti is pretty obvious, S-H-A-N-G-T-E-E, but that's transliteration, anglicizing of the Chinese characters, which they found already in popular use. The earliest preachers accepted the Chinese words Tian and Shangti, which they found already there in popular use. The word Tian, however, according to the Imperial Dictionary of the Kangi, means the Great One, He that dwells on high and regulates all below. It is also used in a physical and material sense as heaven, and in that sense it constantly occurs in the most familiar language. It is even used in the sense of day. Qian Tian, literally new heaven, means only today. And Ming Tian, literally bright heaven, means tomorrow. We must here add that exactly the same takes place in Sanskrit. From the same root div, from which we have seen Zeus, Deus, and Theos were derived, we also have Dies and Dia and other languages for day. We see thus that the word Diva, by which in the course of time, the footnotes along the bottom, I got to go back now. We also have Dies in Sanskrit, Diva, day. We have Sanskrit Dios, and in Latin, subdio, in the sense of heaven. Nay, in the same way as the Chinese says Qin Tian, today, the Hindu uses Adiya, literally, this heaven or this day, in the sense of today. Now, on the strength of this supposed equivocal meaning of the word Tian, the Pope, in 1715, issued an apostolic precept by which the missionaries were prohibited from using the word Tian in the sense of God, though they were allowed to use it for heaven. The Pope hath said. The decision of the Pope was, of course, final. And it was implicitly obeyed by the Roman Catholic missionaries of every order. The phrase Tien Chu, or Lord of Heaven, has accordingly been universally and invariably adopted by all Chinese Roman Catholic Christians from that time to this day. Whether in passages like that in the parable of the prodigal son, I have sinned against heaven, the Pope would have allowed the use of Tien. That phrase does not appear. He took it out. He has equally excommunicated the other Chinese word for God, Shang Ti, which is the same as Tien, heaven, that is the God of heaven. The Abbe Grotier, in his History of China, gives a striking account of the character and attributes of Shang Ti, the divinity or supreme being, from the king or canonical books of the Chinese. In spite of this, you can't erase the culture. Tien and Shang Ti were stigmatized by the Roman Catholics as heathen idols. Not better than Zeus, which modern Protestants would stigmatize, or Jupiter of the Greeks and Latins. As a natural consequence, the Christians are popularly considered by the Chinese as the intruders, or the introducers, rather, of a new and strange god, a sort of idol of theirs, a Christian idol, which they call Tien Chu. And this notion has been sedulously inculcated until very lately in successive edicts by the government. We hope that the views so admirably advocated by Sir G. Staunton may prevail with the missionary societies in Europe and America, and that the old word Shang Ti may be readopted by Christians of whatever denomination in China. Upon a deliberate consideration of all the bearings of the question, Sir George observes, quote, "It still may be right to reject the term Tien Chu, but I cannot agree with those who think that this should be done upon the specific ground of it being advantageous or desirable that Protestant and Roman Catholic Christians in China should be distinguished from each other by their employment of different words for the deity. This distinction may be unavoidable, but it must always be a matter of regret from its tendency to suggest to the Chinese that Protestants and Roman Catholics do not worship the same God, which is not only untrue in itself, but is a mischievous exaggeration of the difference between two forms of faith, which can have no other effect in China but that of discrediting our common Christianity." You know, it doesn't pay to be a dumb Christian. It really doesn't. Here you have, in every culture, an eternity in their hearts, and other books that I've read from, modern archaeology is beginning to prove, without exception, that man didn't start out as a polytheistic idol worshiper. The earliest concepts of God brought down from our common heritage in Adam and Eve, the oldest names for God and the oldest beliefs of God had one supreme being over all. It's our ignorance of preach first and learn second that has produced the confusion. Theos. Paul did not invent the word. And the Greeks borrowed it from the Sanskrit Aryans. And it's the old Diu and the old Div. And with that, I'm going to stop making this holiday such a heavy time together and make you start working. Get on the telephone.